HarperCollins and Harper Audio present The Cage, a novel by Bonnie Kistler, performed by Piper Goodeve and Chris Andrew Shula.
Prologue. The fog hovered high over the city, invisible in the cold night sky, except for the diffused reflection of the urban skyglow. The only surface it touched was Marketplace Tower, the city's newest and tallest office building, where it painted a coat of rime over every sparkling facet of the spire. If anyone could see it, they might imagine a sugar-frosted fairyland, but no one could, in the fog, in the dark. Down on the street, a van stopped at the entrance to discharge a crew of three men. As they unloaded their machines from the back and wheeled them to the door, one of the men, the new one, paused on the pavement and looked up, and up some more. The 30 stories that loomed over the street were dark, except for two gauzy glimmers on the topmost floor. He craned his head back farther. The two lights glowed on opposite sides of the building, and as the fog drifted through the sky, they dimmed and brightened like lighthouse lanterns warning of two separate hazards. In the building's lobby, a guard sat at a security console that faced the three sets of revolving doors. CCTV videos lit up four screens in front of him. On the fifth, he was watching the game. Behind him stretched the bank of elevators, five cars on either side with a destination dispatch console between them. Their doors were etched with a gridwork of black bars, an homage to the old cage-style elevators of the Edwardian era. The three men buzzed for entry, and the guard looked up and pushed a button to release the lock. They signed in and stowed their coats in an empty office off the lobby, rubbernecked the TV, and asked for the score. 22-0, the guard told them. They whistled, then started up their machines and tugged on their headphones to listen to the game as they worked. The lobby floor was sienna marble inlaid with geometric diamonds of onyx, and the polishers glided over it like Zambonis. 30 floors up, a woman stood very still at her office window. On a clear day, she could see the Manhattan skyline. Tonight, she saw nothing but her own reflection. She was in her early 40s, slender and petite, with alabaster skin and faded blonde hair cut in a stylish swoop. Although it was a Sunday night, her makeup was flawless, and she was dressed for a workday, in a silk blouse and tailored trousers and pointed toe heels with the distinctive red soles that marked them as a high three-figure purchase. She gazed at herself in the darkness, her face utterly still, until at last she turned and picked up her coat and pulled her office door shut behind her. A beep sounded as the electronic lock engaged, and she headed down the corridor. At the far end of the same floor, on the side without a view, the other point of light shone over a different desk. Its surface was covered with stacks of paper, flying flags of multicolored tabs on the margins, and topped with post-it notes. In the shadows, 6 feet away, stood a different woman, 6 inches taller and 10 years younger. She looked even younger, with her sloppy ponytail and pale bearskin face. She, too, was dressed for a workday, though not in designer wear, and she, too, stared at her reflection in the glass. But her face wasn't still. A muscle twitched at the corner of one bleary eye, winking on and off like a semaphore. She'd been at her desk for more than 14 hours. Wearily, she turned, slid some papers into a battered canvas bag, and picked up her coat. There was no lock on her office door, and she left it standing open. As she trudged to the elevator, a hush swelled through the penthouse corridors, broken only by the abiding hum of the building's mechanicals. They wheezed like a hospital ventilator on a comatose patient. When she arrived at the elevator bank, the older woman was already there. She didn't respond when the younger woman spoke to her. The center elevator arrived. The doors slid open. The women stepped on. The doors closed.
911, what's your emergency? We're stuck in an elevator. The power's gone out.
Okay. Can you tell me your name?
Shay Lambert.
What's your location?
Marketplace Tower. We're stuck in the elevator. The power's completely out. I pressed the alarm button, but nothing happened. The intercom isn't working, and the air compressor's out too, I think. We're in total darkness.
Is someone there with you?
One other person. Lucy Barton Jones. This is her phone I'm calling on.
Is she all right?
I'm not sure. She seems pretty upset.
Let me talk to her.
Okay. Hold on. I have to turn on the phone lights so I can see where she is. Okay. There. They want to talk to you. I'm putting the phone to her ear.
Hello? This is the 911 operator. Can you tell me your name? Hello? Are you all right?
Hi, it's me again. Lucy's not talking. She seems really out of it. We need to get her out of here.
The fire bureau has been dispatched. Please stay on the line.
I don't know. This phone's about to die. It's got like 1% charge left.
Stay on the line. Rescue workers will be there soon.
No, I better conserve the battery. I might need the flashlight again.
Best if you stay on the line, ma'am.
No, but thank you.
Hello? Hello?
Part 1.
Chapter 1. February 2nd, 2014. 11:16 p.m. The motor started up with a chug of gears that sounded like teeth gnashing. The lights flashed on, and I scrambled up off the floor and charged for the doors. The elevator plunged beneath my feet, so fast it felt like freefall. But I didn't care. I wanted down. I wanted out. In seconds, we reached the lobby level. The doors opened, and I burst out into a semicircle of waiting men. They were a blur of uniforms, policemen, firefighters, security guard, men in coveralls with oval name patches on their chests. I stopped and stared at them, but they were all staring past me, into the elevator. I turned. Lucy Barton Jones was sprawled in the corner of the car. Her eyes were open inside raccoon circles of mascara, and she had a hole in her left cheek, so neat it looked like someone had taken a paper punch to her face. On the wall above her was a splatter of blood and gore, and on the floor beside her was the gun, a snub-nosed revolver in a matte black finish. I felt sick, and then I was sick. I doubled over and heaved out a stream of yellow bile all over the gleaming marble floor. Two men lunged at me from either side, and they hoisted me up, their hands tight on my elbows and wrists. My toes dragged the floor as they propelled me across the lobby and through a glass door into an empty office. It was furnished only with a metal desk and a chair, and a coat rack hung heavy with winter coats. I looked around for my own coat before I remembered it was back there, on the floor of the elevator, near the gun. I looked down. My suit jacket started out that day as a solid, boring beige. Now it was leopard print, or cheetah, or some other predator splattered with the blood of its kill. The sight of it made me want to vomit again. I tore frantically at the buttons, and the two men jumped to restrain me until they saw what I was doing. They helped me remove the jacket, and one of them bore it away as the other pressed me down into the chair. "My coat," I said. "My things." I tried to remember what else I'd left behind. My briefcase, my purse.
"They're being secured," he said.
The first man returned and handed me a plastic cup of water. He wore the uniform of a police officer. I turned to the other man and saw that he did too. The cup trembled in my hand, and the water sloshed from side to side like waves lapping at a dock.
I gulped a mouthful and swirled it around my teeth and spat it back into the cup. My hands were shaking badly. I stared at them, then at my fingernails. They were torn and ragged, and I remembered how I'd dug my fingertips into the crack between the elevator doors, how hard I'd pulled and strained to open them. I'd broken every nail, and the door never budged.
"What happened?" one officer asked, while the other said, "What's your name?"
A different uniform came through the door. This one was a firefighter, and he stayed only long enough to shake his head. One of the officers stepped out into the lobby. I twisted around to watch through the glass door as he spoke into his shoulder-mounted radio. My brain wasn't working right. It took until that moment for me to realize what the firefighter's headshake meant. With a gasp, I spun to the remaining cop. "She's dead?" He watched me closely and didn't answer, and that told me what the answer was. "Oh, God." I dropped my face into my hands. "I should have tried. I don't know. Could I have saved her?" My voice was strained and muffled against my palms. I looked up again. "It was dark," I said. "I couldn't see where she was hurt, or even if she was hurt. I don't know what I could have done. What should I have done?"
"What happened?" he said again.
I took a breath to steady myself. "She had a panic attack," I said. "I guess that's what you'd call it. When the elevator stalled and the lights went out, she was making these sounds, I don't know, like a dog panting. I tried to get her to calm down. I told her that building security had to know what happened. We'd be out in no time. But it was like she didn't hear me. The intercom wasn't working, and it didn't seem like the alarm button worked either, so I called 911. I told her help was on the way, but she didn't respond. She was definitely hyperventilating by then. I was afraid she'd pass out. So I turned the phone light on to check on her. That's when I saw the gun in her hand." I closed my eyes and took another deep breath. I couldn't believe she had a gun. I didn't know what she meant to do with it. Shoot her way out? But then she was turning it, pointing it under her chin, and I realized she meant to shoot herself. I shouted, "No!" and I grabbed for the gun. But she fought me. She fought me so hard. And then... I stopped and took another swallow of water from the paper cup. But it tasted of vomit, and I hurried to spit it out.
"She killed herself, you're saying?"
I squinted at him. Did I not make that clear? "Yes." He took out a notepad.
"Do you know her name?"
"Yes, she's Lucy Barton Jones."
"Lucy Jones,"
he said, jotting. "No, Barton Jones, with a hyphen. It's one of those double-barreled British names, you know?" He looked up, blank-faced.
"Friend of yours?"
"She's the HR director of our company."
"What company is that?"
"CDMI. When he looked blank again, I explained. "Claudine DeMartino International, the fashion giant. We own most of the major labels around the world. Our design headquarters are in the city, but our administrative headquarters are here." I pointed upward. CDMI occupied the top 5 floors of the building.
"What's your name?"
"Shay Lambert. I work in the law department." His eyes narrowed.
"You're a lawyer?"
I nodded. The other cop returned to the room.
"CID's been alerted."
His partner pointed at me.
"She's a lawyer,"
he said. The two men exchanged a look, and as one gave a nod, the other pulled a laminated card from his pocket and began to read.
"You have the right to remain—"
"Wait." My eyes darted between the two men. "You don't think—" "No, she killed herself." He kept on reading in a monotone.
"Silent. Anything you say can and will be used—"
"I tried to stop her."
His partner left the room again and went into a huddle with two newly arrived uniformed officers. The three of them went through the revolving doors to the street.
"Yes, I understand my rights," I said when the officer was done reading. "I waive them. I'll tell you everything. I tried to stop her."
"Wait here."
He exited the room, but he didn't go far. He stopped and stood just outside the door. He was standing guard, I realized. He was standing guard over me.
Chapter 2. The principal residence of J. Ingram Barrett, Jr. was in Rye, a classic white colonial, three-story stall, its facade uplit with a dozen well-positioned landscaping spots that made it look like the star of the street. Another set of lights shone on the fountain in the middle of the circle drive that looped around to the front entrance. Thanks to a submersible heater, the water cascaded all through the winter. In the master suite on the second floor, Barrett slept in a California king with his phone under his pillow. The phone was equipped with a bedshaker ring, like those in alarm clocks for the deaf. This allowed him to receive middle-of-the-night phone calls without disturbing Melanie, asleep on the far side of the bed. Running a company with production facilities in Southeast Asia meant he often received middle-of-the-night calls, and Melanie wasn't pleased when it happened. As much as she enjoyed the income that came with his position as Senior Vice President and General Counsel of CDMI, she resented any reminder that he had to work for it. The phone shook him awake, and he pulled the blanket over his head before he looked at the screen. The caller wasn't on the other side of the globe. It was Jack Culligan, and since he was head of corporate security for CDMI, a call after midnight had to mean a crisis. Barrett slipped out of bed and stole into his separate bath and through to his dressing room before he answered. "I'll call you back," he whispered, and disconnected. He left by the other door directly into the hall and passed the four empty bedrooms that nominally belonged to his children, though they seldom occupied them. He trotted down the helical staircase and skidded when his foot met wet floor at the bottom.
"God damn it,"
he snarled as he caught himself on the newel post of the banister. The maid was on her hands and knees scrubbing the travertine floor tiles in the foyer.
"Sorry, mister, so sorry."
She crouched back on her haunches and cowered behind her upflung arms.
"Oh, for God's sake," he said.
He would have preferred the cleaning to be done while he was at the office, but he knew that Melanie ordered the wet work to be done during the wee hours of the morning so as not to interfere with any of her activities during the rest of the day.
"Relax," he told the maid. "I'm not mad."
He picked his way across the damp floor and into his office and closed the door before he called Culligan.
"What?" he snapped when the man answered. "Barry, it's about Lucy." "Oh, fuck."
He circled around his desk.
"What did she do?"
"Nothing. She's dead."
"Jesus."
He sat down hard in his chair.
"Where?" "The office. In the elevator. Gunshot to the head."
"Oh, God." "Were there warning signs?" people always asked. And Barrett tried to think. There were certainly signs that she was bent on destruction, but he thought it was the company she was out to destroy, not herself.
"I could burn this place down," she'd threatened,
which left him no choice but to remind her what the consequences would be if she tried.
"Did she say anything?" he asked Culligan. "Before?"
"No. By the time they were rescued, she was already dead."
"Wait. They?
Rescued from what?"
"She was trapped in the elevator with one of yours. Shay Lambert."
Barrett stood up abruptly.
"Can we get to her?"
"Too late. The cops have her sequestered. And she's already made a statement."
"Saying?"
"Claustrophobia. Panic attack."
"Okay."
He digested that.
"Where are you getting this?"
"Night guard chatted up one of the beat cops. By the way, they left me a voicemail asking for access to search Lucy's office. And Shay's."
Barrett thought for a moment.
install them. Get to Lucy's office. Look for a note, anything on her computer. Anything. I'll go to her house and prep the husband. Send Lester to meet me there. We'll need to search there, too. Got it. Jack? Yeah? Did she give you any idea? No. At least, no more than you. Barrett bristled. I didn't have a clue. Then neither did I. He didn't care for the CYA subtext in that remark. But now is not the time. Report back after you've been through her office. He disconnected and got dressed in the middle of the night crisis clothes he kept hanging in his office closet for occasions like this. Not that there had ever been an occasion like this. I could burn this place down, Lucy had threatened. And maybe now, through her death, she'd done it. If so, the flames wouldn't stop with the company. They'd incinerate him, too. He started for the garage. But before he reached the mudroom, he turned and went back to his study and opened the wall safe. Inside, under his passport and some cash and jewelry, was a single unopened pack of cigarettes. He'd quit nearly a year ago, but kept the pack here as a test of his willpower. He was a man who liked to be in control at all times, even of himself. Especially of himself. But not tonight. He slit the cellophane seal and tapped out a cigarette, then tapped out two, then put the whole pack in his pocket and closed the safe. He lit up as soon as he reached the garage.
Chapter 3. I tried to calm myself. A woman was dead. Obviously, the police would have questions, and as the only witness, I was the only one who could answer them. The reading of the Miranda warning was nothing more than a patrol officer being overly cautious until the detectives arrived. And even then, he probably read it only because I was a lawyer. I was stupid to mention that. Cops always went on their guard when dealing with lawyers. I watched the proceedings through the glass door of the little lobby office. Two other cops assembled some panels into a screen and set it up in front of the open doors of Car 3. It was a crime scene screen, I realized. They were treating the elevator as a crime scene. But suicide wasn't a crime in the state of New York. Homicide was. Another cop was herding three men in janitorial coveralls through the lobby. He had them sit on the floor at least 20 feet from one another. The witnesses were being sequestered. Yet another cop was still standing guard outside my door. The suspect was being detained? No, of course not, I tried to convince myself. I was a witness, not a suspect. I was being sequestered, not detained. All of this was completely routine. But my lawyer's brain was too analytical to overlook the obvious. There were only two people in that elevator, and only two possibilities: suicide or homicide. The police wouldn't accept the first until they eliminated the second. That meant it was my job to convince them that I didn't do it. I needed to prove that negative. I waited and watched, and everyone else seemed to be waiting and watching as well. In the long silence, I became aware of the ringing in my ears. I wasn't sure whether it just started or whether it was only this moment that I noticed it. I remembered the sound of the gunshot so close to my ear. The blast had been deafening in that tiny space, swelling until it took up every cubic inch of the elevator car. Car? Why did they call them cars? Elevators weren't cars. In a car, you were in control. You could stop, pull over, get out, walk free. They should call them what they were. Cages. That was what it felt like when I was trapped in there, in the dark. My hands weren't shaking anymore. Now it was my mouth that trembled, though if I clamped my jaws shut, I could hold it still. At the same time, though, the ringing in my ears was growing louder and louder. I wondered if my hearing might be permanently damaged. Then I wondered how I could worry about something like that when I was lucky even to be alive. Our struggle over the gun had been ferocious. It was astonishing how fiercely such a small woman could fight, and it easily could have fired on me instead. My hands started to shake again, and I clasped them together and held them tightly on the desk in front of me, like a schoolgirl. The best little girl in the class. That was what I always was. Always attentive, always ready with the answer, and my arm thrust in the air. Back in the days when that was all I needed to succeed. Another image flashed through my memory. Lucy's eyes as I wrestled her for the gun, in the crazy kaleidoscope of light that played up from her phone on the floor. Her wild animal eyes. Lucy had a face like fine porcelain, smooth and utterly immobile. But during those last awful moments, it shattered into a million tiny shards. New voices rumbled from the lobby, and I looked out as two men came through the revolving doors. One was young and short, and wore a top coat and a racing cap. The other was old and tall, and wore a parka and a pair of ancient rubber galoshes. All the other men seemed to snap to attention at their arrival. These two must be the detectives. They were the ones I had to convince. My jury of two. They stopped and spoke to the uniformed officers, and all of them turned and looked at me. The younger man was Latino, I thought, while the older one had the florid complexion of an Irishman, or a drunk, or both. They ducked behind the crime scene screen into car 3. They were in there a long time. When they came out, they talked to the security guard at the desk. The young one took notes. The old one stood and listened with his hands in his pockets. They moved on to the janitorial workers sitting cross-legged on the lobby floor. The first one rose to his feet as the detectives approached. The younger detective did all the talking, much of it in Spanish, and he took all the notes. They moved on to the next worker and the next, with the younger one taking the lead each time. When they'd finished with all three, they said something to the officer standing guard outside my little room, and he came in and pulled the coats off the rack. He didn't speak to me or look at me, but went back and passed out the coats to the janitorial workers. They shrugged them on, unplugged their machines, and wheeled them out to a van waiting at the curb. Another van was unloading its crew outside. Men and women, two of each, black and white, also two of each. They pushed through the revolving doors, hauling big aluminum cases of gear after them. They suited up in Tyvek coveralls and booties, and after a brief conference with the detectives, disappeared behind the screen. They were the medical examiner's team, I guessed, or the crime scene investigators. The detectives stood and talked to each other for a few moments. Then they went into another huddle with the uniformed officers standing guard over me. Then at last, they came in to see me. They introduced themselves. The old, tall one was Detective Riley. The young, short one was Detective Cruz. I leaned into their shields as they held them up for inspection. The letters swam in my eyes, and I had to blink before I could make out their names. Riley was Joseph. Cruz was Carl. Criminal Investigation Division was emblazoned on both shields. CID.
Ms. Lambert, is it?
This was the younger detective, Cruz. He was in his 30s, I guessed, and he had a neatly trimmed goatee and big liquid eyes like a waif in a Margaret Keane painting. Yes.
Do you need any medical attention? We can get an EMT in here or take you to the hospital, whatever you need.
No. No, I'm fine. Well, I mean, I don't need medical attention.
Anything we can get for you?
A few hours ago, I was faint with hunger and almost delirious with exhaustion, but there was no way I could eat or sleep now. I shook my head.
Is there anyone we can call for you?
I shook my head again.
Not your husband?
Cruz was staring at my wedding ring. No. I folded my hands on my lap. He's not reachable.
We could send a patrol car for him,
he offered. No, you see, he works nights, but thank you.
Any friend we could call?
I wouldn't want to bother them, not at this hour.
Any other family?
No. When he seemed to wait for more, I added, my mother's dead. I never knew my father, and I was an only child. He gave a sympathetic nod. He didn't seem to be treating me like a suspect, or even like a witness. It was almost like I was a victim. In a way, maybe I was. The older detective, Riley, planted his hip on the edge of the desk. Up close, I could see that he was much older. The skin under his eyes sagged like wet tea bags. The hair on his head was gray, and so were the little tufts sprouting from his ears and nose. But his eyebrows were strangely black. They crawled like caterpillars across his brow as he studied me.
Can you tell us what happened?
His voice was an octave lower than Cruz's, and sounded like a rusty rowboat being dragged over a rocky beach. I'd had 60 minutes, maybe 90, I didn't have a watch, to calm down and organize my thoughts and not blurt it out as I'd done before. My voice shook a bit, but I was able to relate the events coherently, from my arrival at the elevator bank on the 30th floor until the moment the doors finally opened on the ground floor. Cruz absently stroked his goatee as he listened.
That must have been awful, he said when I was done. You sure we can't call somebody for you?
No, but thank you. He pointed to the two Tyvek-clad women hovering outside the door.
Some folks here need to come in and get you a change of clothes and take some photos, if that's all right with you.
I hesitated. A victim would have no reason to refuse, and neither would a witness. Only a suspect would object, so obviously I couldn't. Of course, that's fine. The detectives left, and the women came in. They wore caps over their hair and face masks over their mouths and noses. It was like they were wearing hazmat suits, and I felt a reflexive shame, like I was contagious or contaminated. One of them had a camera, and the other was carrying little plastic containers. If you'd put your hands on the desk, please, the first one said. I spread my hands out, and she photographed them palms up and palms down. Then the other woman opened one of the plastic containers and removed a disc that she pressed against my right hand. It had adhesive backing, and I realized it was meant to collect gunshot residue. The moment of the gunshot flashed in my memory. I could hear the roar and smell the odor and see Lucy's crazed animal eyes all over again. I could feel the heat, too, the hot metal of the barrel searing against my hands, and I knew that the test would be positive for GSR. The technician returned the disc to the container and sealed and labeled it, then repeated the procedure with my other hand. Stand up against the wall, please, the woman with the camera said. Shakily, I pushed back from the desk and stood where I was told. I tried not to blink as I was photographed again, full body this time, front and back.
If you'd remove your skirt and blouse, please, and your shoes.
What?
If you would, please.
Cooperate, I reminded myself. I had to seem cooperative. They blocked the view from the door as I stripped down to my underwear. Then they handed me a gray sweatshirt and sweatpants. These must have been their all-purpose, one-size, supposed-to-fit-all garments for anyone who couldn't come up with their own change of clothes. Apparently, they didn't have any all-purpose shoes. Instead, they gave me a pair of Tyvek booties, like the ones they wore on their own feet. Then they bagged up my clothes and shoes and labeled them.
Open your mouth, please.
A swab brushed the inside of my cheek and around my gums. Finally, they rolled my fingerprints and packed up their kits and left the room. I sat back down at the desk. The clothes were too big for me, and the hood trailed down my back like a monk's cowl. The paper booties were meant to go over shoes, so they were too big as well, and rough against my bare feet. I wasn't shaking anymore. The adrenaline was finally wearing off, and fatigue was creeping in behind it. I'd been up since, what, 4:30 this morning? I'd arrived in the office at 6:30, and now it was, what? I looked around for a clock. I didn't even know if it was still today. I felt a tremendous urge to put my head down on the desk and close my eyes, just for a minute. But I couldn't. I had to stay alert. I had to be on guard. There were only two possible scenarios of what happened in the elevator. Either Lucy killed herself, or I killed Lucy. Now that I'd been photographed and swabbed and fingerprinted and processed in every way like a suspect, I couldn't avoid the obvious anymore. No matter how sympathetic the detectives seemed to be, unless they were utterly convinced of suicide, they were going to default to murder. I could see them out there in the lobby, conferring with the crime scene specialists. They kept glancing at me as they spoke. At last, they returned to the room. Forensics won't help, I blurted as they cleared the doorway. We both had our hands on the gun when it went off, so I probably do have residue on my hands, and the gun will have my prints and DNA, too. Riley shrugged.
They're just routine tests.
We have to go notify the victim's family now, Cruz said.
But we'd like to pick up our conversation when we get back, if that's all right with you.
Of course, whatever I can do to help.
It's best if we talk over at CID, he said, if you wouldn't mind riding over there and waiting for us.
Riding?
In a patrol car. The uniforms will take you to CID and get you settled until we get back.
All right.
It shouldn't be more than an hour or two.
That's fine. That meant two more hours of waiting, after however many hours I'd waited already. But it would give me time to recover, time for the tinnitus to fade, time to shut down the strobing replay of Lucy's face. I'd have time to gather my thoughts and time to prepare my opening statement, my presentation of the evidence, and my closing argument to my jury of two. By then, I'd be ready for them.
Chapter 4. Lucy's kitchen was immaculate. All the hard surfaces were polished to a high gleam, with not a smudge on the stainless, not a crumb on the granite. She had a housekeeper, of course, but Barrett was certain that the state of this room was all down to Lucy. She was equally as anal at the office, with never more than a single document on her desk, and often not even that. Likewise, all the surfaces here were bare. The spices were alphabetized, the cans in the pantry organized by expiration date, the knives precisely lined up like miniature samurai swords on the magnetic rack. This was Lucy, all right. She was too fastidious for her own good. Barrett's phone buzzed. It was the call he'd been waiting for. Anything? He kept his voice low. The husband was in the next room, and the children asleep upstairs.
Nothing in her office, Jack Culligan reported. Nothing on her computer. Nothing unusual on the video.
Lester Willard came down the back stairs, ducking his head to clear the ceiling. He was all in black, skin and clothes, even down to his black latex gloves. Barrett directed the same question to him.
Anything? No, sir. You got everything in place?
Yes, sir. House and car.
Barrett put Culligan on speaker so Lester could hear, too. The three of them comprised his entire crisis response team now that Lucy was gone. CEO Phil Duvall should have been here with them, too. But he'd made it clear that he didn't want to be consulted, updated, or even blind copied. Plausible deniability were his watchwords.
We can't rule out her briefcase and handbag, Culligan said. but our man on the desk watched the cops search them at the scene, and they didn't react like there was any kind of note inside.
Okay, Barrett said,
but he knew it wasn't okay. It wasn't enough that Lucy hadn't left a note confessing everything. It wouldn't shut down the questions. A woman with no history of mental illness, successful in her career, and happy in her home life, didn't kill herself for no reason. People would go looking for that reason. They'd ask questions, and other people would start to remember things, like how upset she'd seemed after that last trip to Myanmar, or how strangely she'd behaved at that seminar last month. Somebody would put it all together. He'd done all the damage control he could think of, but it wasn't enough. He reached for a cigarette and flicked his lighter, and as the flame burst out, he imagined the feel of it, licking at his feet. I could burn this place down. One more thing, Culligan said. Our man overheard something. The gun? It was a ghost gun.
What the fuck's that?
Homemade. They sell these DIY kits online, and any bozo with basic machining skills can put it together.
Jesus. Is that legal?
Barrett said. Not that he cared, but as a lawyer, he always liked to know.
Legal to build, legal to own. It's only illegal to sell to somebody else. But Barry, here's the thing. There's no serial number. There's no registration.
You mean it's untraceable?
Almost always.
Barrett blinked. Suddenly, there was an earthquake in his landscape of possibilities.
Hold on a minute. Let me think.
He held up a hand at Lester, a crossing guard's command to halt even though the man hadn't moved. If Barrett could have a superpower, this was what it would be. The ability to freeze a scene and all the other players in it. Then he could take his time to think and strategize, maybe even peek into the others' files. And when he was ready for them, snap his fingers and bring them all back to life. He didn't need a superpower with these players, though. They worked for him. Lester froze where he stood, and Culligan remained obediently silent on the phone.
Hey, listen, Jack, Barrett said finally. What if it wasn't suicide?
What? Culligan's voice crackled over the line.
She didn't leave a note, and it wasn't her gun. And she wasn't alone in that elevator.
Huh.
Lester, Barrett said abruptly, and the tall man snapped to attention. Do we have to worry about Lambert? Anything she could do or say?
No, sir. She never broke protocol. Not once.
But what's her motive? Culligan asked.
I'll take care of that. Barrett had long known that the secret to being a good lawyer was the ability to define the issue and thereby direct the avenue of inquiry. Instead of wondering why Lucy killed herself, people would wonder why Lambert killed her. They'd go looking in the other direction, and he could control what they found.
All right, then, he decided. That's our play. Everybody got it?
He didn't wait for them to answer. Jack, any ETA on the cops?
They left here 10 minutes ago.
Okay. Lester's heading back in now. Barrett pointed him to the back door.
Pull all your background on Shay Lambert, he said to Culligan. Pull the video. I'll meet you in tech in an hour.
The call ended, but Lester still stood there in the kitchen, shifting uncomfortably from foot to foot. Barrett pocketed his phone.
Is there a problem?
Sir.
Lester cleared his throat.
She's a nice girl. She didn't do nothing wrong.
I know, Barrett heaved a sigh.
It's a damn shame.
She was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Lester bowed his head, and after a moment, he gave a nod and slipped soundlessly out the back door. Elliot Gutman was in the living room, slumped on the low-slung silk-covered sofa. He wore a turquoise brocade robe that Lucy probably brought back from one of her trips to Asia. It was far too flamboyant for a tweed and elbow patches guy like Gutman. He looked like the academic he was, stoop-shouldered and concave-chested,
with frizzy gray hair and a Dershowitz do, and steel-rimmed glasses in need of some polishing. Barrett cleared his throat as he entered the room, and Gutman looked up, his eyes red and brimming behind the smudged lenses. The police are on their way. Are you up for this, Elliot?
I don't know. What do I need to do?
Just tell the truth. Barrett took a seat on a chinoiserie chair. Lucy's decor was nothing like the English country look one might have expected. Instead of cabbage rose florals, there were embroidered jewel-toned silks. Instead of cherry flooring, teak. Instead of mahogany case goods, bold red lacquerware. If he didn't already know how far she'd renounced her British heritage, he could have guessed by this room. Displayed on the fireplace mantel was a collection of blue and white porcelains amid photographs of their two sons. And the truth is, Barrett said, planting his elbows on the bamboo armrests, Lucy never would have wanted to leave you and the boys.
No, she wouldn't.
She had a happy home and a good life.
Yes.
Nothing was bothering her. Not at home, not at work.
Well,
nothing out of the ordinary. She had a high-stress job, but she coped. She always did.
Yes, but Barry...
Here's the thing, Elliot. Barrett sat down beside him and put a hand on his shoulder. The police are going to be looking for an easy way out. All they want to do is clear their cases and close their files. So they're going to default to suicide, I guarantee it.
Oh.
I can't emphasize enough how important it is that you not let them close this out as suicide. Because that won't end it for you. Everyone will go looking for reasons. What drove her to do it? Was she mentally ill? Was her husband having an affair?
No, my God!
But people will speculate. They'll ask questions. And in 10 years, your boys will be asking those same questions. Gutman winced. If the police think there's any chance the gun was Lucy's, that'll clinch it in their minds. They'll swallow this panic attack nonsense and close their file. And you and your boys will have to live with all those questions for the rest of your lives.
No, I can't let that happen.
You need to protect your children, Elliot. They've already lost their mother. Don't let their memories of her be ruined, too.
No, but...
And not to be crass, but you're their sole provider now. You have to think of that. The company policy on Lucy won't pay out in the event of suicide. That's $10 million. Lost forever. Gutman's red eyes went wide. The doorbell rang. Barrett gave him a reassuring pat on the back as he stood. You can do this, Elliot. Do it for Lucy and your boys. Barrett went to the front door and opened it. Two plainclothes cops were on the semicircular brick porch. One a sad sack white guy, and the other a dapper young Puerto Rican. Barrett sized them up instantly. A has-been and a never-will-be. They held up their shields and pronounced their names. Is this the residence of Lucy Barton Jones? The younger one asked. Yes, please come in. Are you her husband? No, I'm a family friend. He stepped aside to admit them to the foyer. Lucy's husband is just in here. He waved them into the living room and made the introductions. Elliot, these are Detectives Riley and Cruz. Detectives, Elliot Gutman, Lucy's husband. Widower, he amended. Gutman made a noise and buried his face in his hands. Cruz looked at Barrett. I take it he's already been notified? Barrett nodded. By building security. Is that right, Elliot? Gutman cleared his throat.
Right.
Please, have a seat, Barrett said. They each sat gingerly in a chair facing Gutman. Barrett stayed on his feet, poised to swoop in if he had to. But he didn't. It was an ordinary quiet weekend, Gutman told them. Their boys had a swim meet at the club that afternoon, and they all went out for pizza afterward at Vinny's in Greenwich. After dinner, Lucy went to the office to take an overseas conference call. No, she didn't own a gun. Neither of them did. She'd never even fired one. No, she didn't suffer from panic attacks, and she wasn't claustrophobic. No, she had no history of depression or substance abuse or any other mental illness. They had a happy marriage and 2 young children. There was no way she'd take her own life. He broke down at that last part. The timing so perfect, Barrett could have scripted it for him.
I'm very sorry, sir, Cruz said. How long were you married, if I might ask?
Gutman swallowed hard.
12 years.
And she was British, is that right? He nodded.
Yes, although she was born in Malaysia. Her family used to own property there. But she was educated in England and started her career there.
How'd you two happen to meet?
I was speaking at a conference at LSE,
Louisiana State.
This interjection came from the older detective, Riley.
The London School of Economics, Gutman said, pained. Lucy came up afterward with some follow-up questions, and we continued the conversation over dinner, and we kept in touch as best we could after that. I was teaching at Princeton at the time, and she was in the London office of CDMI. After she was promoted to the headquarters office here in New York, we started seeing each other.
What'd you talk about? Riley said.
Gutman swung a bewildered look his way.
The usual things you talk about when you're dating.
I mean, at the conference. What was your speech about?
Oh, monetizing human capital in the global economy.
What's that mean? How to put a price tag on your workers?
No, Gutman sputtered, indignant. Human capital refers to the skill sets of the workforce and their value or cost. I developed some metrics for use in making a comparative valuation in different parts of the world. But what's this got to do with Lucy's murder?
The two detectives exchanged a look, and they stood up and pocketed their notepads and offered their condolences.
Mind if we have a little look around? Cruz said, like it was an afterthought.
Barrett would have allowed it, but before he could speak, Gutman shot to his feet, suddenly ferocious and billowing silk turquoise.
Yes, I damn well do mind. My children are asleep. They've lost their mother. Show some goddamn respect.
The detectives murmured their apologies, and Barrett showed them to the door. But Gutman wasn't done with them yet. He called after them.
You're holding her, right? The woman who did this? You won't let her get away!
They didn't answer him, just murmured their goodnights and left. Barrett closed the door after them and turned back to Gutman with a nod of approval.
You're a good dad, Elliot, he said.